Welcome back to the MJA podcast. My name's Kate Swanell. Today I have the pleasure of talking with four senior women leaders in medicine from Melbourne. Professor Helena Teed is Executive Director of Monash Partners Academic Health Sciences Centre, and she's also an endocrinologist at Monash Health. Dr. Elizabeth Sigston is an ear, nose and throat consultant surgeon at Monash Health, and she's also a senior lecturer at Monash University. Associate Professor Jacqueline Boyle is a consultant obstetrician and gynaecologist at Monash. She is also Deputy Director of the Monash Centre for Health Research and Implementation. And finally, Dr. Anju Johan is a consultant endocrinologist at Monash Health and an NHMRC Early Career Fellow at Monash University. You'll be unsurprised to discover that we are talking about the advancement of women in medical leadership. Let's give the listeners a bit of a background. Helena, you've written a piece for the MJA on advancing women in medical leadership, something you all know a lot about, given your various positions. Have any of you experienced big barriers to getting where you are? You're all leaders.
I think one of the challenges, or one of the reasons that prompted this particular article, was the barriers that do exist. They have attenuated over time, but they are still very much alive and well. The challenge now is that those barriers are not so much explicit, but more, if you like, unconscious bias. And they exist at a systems policy level, at an organisational level, and at an individual level. But with the much greater awareness, there's now a strong desire by both male and female leaders, organisations, policymakers, to actually overcome some of those barriers and to make sure we progress, support and enable women to attain their leadership and career goals and optimise their working life balance.
Liz, have you encountered any barriers, deliberate or otherwise?
Yes, I have. I think I probably didn't notice it so much when I was more junior. I had my children before I was taken into advanced surgical training and was actually the first mother to be taken into a training position. And in reflection, and it came up at one of our training board meetings, that I didn't really talk about that I had children or that I was married, and most people found out by accident, which seemed to be the right thing at the time, but I think what it also did was create some unrealistic expectations of what was the right way to go about things. And okay. I've noticed as I've got more senior that I've become a lot more aware of the bias and have actually found the barriers to be bigger and stronger as you've become more aware of them. I think I just didn't notice them before. And a lot of it is unconscious. And for example, so even just yesterday we had a clinical meeting, which at the end of it, the chair said, "Thank you, gentlemen." And you look around the room and half of the room are women. I brought it up after the meeting and, you know, and the person who was a chair was quite embarrassed, didn't even realise they'd said it.
Jackie, what about you?
So I think that things have changed, but certainly when I was training, doing obstetrics and gynaecology, there was no real maternity leave. I was told I could take my 6 weeks annual leave or I had to take a year off from the training program. That was quite difficult and frustrating at the time. And again, I think that whilst there are large numbers of women in medicine and particularly in obstetrics and gynaecology, and in a lot of women in leadership roles coming through, but they're still at that very top, there's a lack of women. And again, yes, Liz, similarly, I've been at many meetings where instead of just saying the chair, it's always the chairman. and they're not always necessarily a man.
Anju, what about your career so far? Have you found any barriers?
I think I'm in an early career stage to everybody else. So for me, it's sometimes still just the logistics. So I've got young children. So it's still sometimes about the practicalities of, you know, am I able to drop the kids off at school? Am I able to get to certain events at school? And for that, I have found that the workplace can be a bit tricky in terms of navigating leave, in terms of getting to those places, especially since school doesn't necessarily give you a lot of notice sometimes. So trying to sort of marry the lack of notice with things that are booked in, so those sort of things. And then, you know, who do you disappoint, the work or the children? You know, that becomes a bit of a tussle.
Kate, can I just also make some reflection on Andrew's challenges? I think the reality is, and in fact it's highlighted in the article, that there are really four key areas of obvious challenge for women in the workplace in terms of leadership roles. And I think we've touched on a few of those. One is that sometimes there is just blatant bias that women may not be capable or women don't aspire to leadership roles. That belief and theme is far less prominent, but probably still alive and well in some areas of surgery. I'll leave Liz to discuss that. But the three themes that are really quite strong and now becoming evidence-based, and Andrew touched on one of those there, is the issue about capacity, perceived capability and credibility. And I've led leadership programs for many years, and in fact the people on the call have actually been facilitating those programs with me. Mm-hmm. And they focus around exactly those themes. So just briefly, the concept of capacity is exactly what Andrew's just described, and all four of us have had to deal with in our career is juggling the burden, most of the burden of parenting and looking after aged parents and running the household. So there is literally a capacity problem. Even though women do tend to be slightly more productive than our male colleagues, we do have a lot more challenges, so our capacity is less.
Yes.
And it drops off at about the age of 31 when it really interrupts your career. The second area that's really important is perceived capability. And overarchingly, that really comes down to confidence women have in their own ability to lead. The way we network, which is just to put our head down and work hard rather than to self-promote and to, you know, go to the golf course days and promote yourself for different positions. And we don't put ourselves forward for awards. We tend to be mentored into more senior roles. We don't apply till we meet all the criteria. And that's quite different to our male colleagues. It's not good or bad. It's just different. We need a different approach to build confidence and to be mentored more effectively, to be trained in leadership.
Yeah. This is what Sheryl Sandberg was talking about when she was talking about leaning in, wasn't she?
Yes, leaning in is exactly right.
Yeah.
And I think the last one, that credibility, which comes down to, are women actually perceived as being credible leaders? If you're the only woman in the room or if you don't look like the gentleman or the chairman, then are you credible when you put yourself forward? And that's even worse for women of diversity ethnically or women of an Indigenous background.
Yes.
They have even more challenges, which Jackie has a lot of expertise in capability building in that area.
I was just going to say that I think part of it's a bit similar to what Helena was saying, was that also women tend to, apart from just putting their head down and working, we also often have different styles of leadership and working. So we may be far more collaborative. And so whilst that's a very valid way of leading, it's not always recognised as a traditional form. So again, that's another way where we can be different.
That's particularly what I see in surgery. You know, leadership is still very much seen as being associated with the position, being associated as that position having the authority to be sort of a command and control type of position. And when you start talking about distributed leadership, when you start talking about building teams, having common purpose and more a collaborative type of leadership, frankly, they actually do not understand what you're talking about. And it's not seen to be leadership, and yet that is the leadership style that's emerging to be the way most successful firms are running, and yet we don't have that in medicine.
Liz, you work in the notoriously unhelpful to women bit of medicine. Do you find you have to change your behaviour in order to get listened to?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. And again, just yesterday, the same meeting that, you know, we have a clinical discussion and we're presenting patients, and you know, my colleagues who are men are asked their opinion 10 times and I will be asked my opinion once, if at all. So I have to actively speak up and offer my opinion rather than wait to be invited. Otherwise, I might as well not be there. And it's hard when it's constant like that and it's gone on for many, many years. Do start seeing, you know, do they understand I'm the most senior person in our unit? I'm actually the most experienced by quite a long way. And that's not reflected, but a lot of it is unconscious.
Was that something you had to learn to speak up?
Yes, absolutely. I'm quite naturally more introverted and, you know, my natural state is to wait to be invited to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a number of years to realise that that doesn't happen. And I think the other thing that has happened in surgery is it's become more acceptable for women to be surgeons, but they're seen more as the helper surgeons in terms of leadership, so that, you know, you make the good 2IC or the person to help, but when it comes to actually being in the leadership position, you're constantly looked as being more junior than your male colleague. I've seen that. I've experienced that. I've been to a performance interview and said, you know, for an early stage surgeon, what are your goals? And sort of like, I'm due for long service leave. And so that comes about appearance as well.
Yes.
So, you know, do you stop colouring your hair? Do you stop wearing makeup so that you look older? And you seem to be the same. It's sort of that sort of, again, unconscious bias that really impacts on the opportunities for leadership and how we're perceived.
Do you still believe it's unconscious in surgery?
I would like to think most of it is,
yeah.
And particularly the College of Surgeons has done a lot of work in this area. And the two examples that I provided, in both cases, in both of that, and I mentioned to one of my other colleagues, I said, did you notice that? And it was like, oh, I didn't even notice it, but now you point it out. Yeah, that did happen.
Yeah.
And so I do think it is unconscious. And I think it's really important to actually raise awareness, because otherwise I'm sitting there thinking, is this being done on purpose? And unless you ask the question,
that can drive you mad,
then you have your own, yeah, you have your own bias on what's actually taken place as well. So it's important to actually ask the question. And I guess in a way that's not challenging, but just pointed out rather than being, accusing people.
It's not even just men that do it, it's actually women.
Yes.
In fact, when I was writing this article, Kate, I started the article because I was given the opportunity to give the oration at the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. And the BMJ editor was in the audience and then invited this paper following it. The oration was the Priscilla Kincaid Smith oration.
Mm-hmm.
And I started this article by introducing Priscilla Kincaid Smith and then the actual topic of the oration. And I started by saying she was a mother, she was a wife, and then went on to all her accolades in her career. And my husband read it and he said, why would you do that? I wouldn't start an article by saying he was a father, he was a, my husband. I would start with his accolades. So even as a woman, I had this unconscious bias in presenting her. And I think, you know, even my own career recently, I hate to admit it, but I fall for it all the time. I don't put myself forward for positions. I'm mentored into them. I often am concerned that I may not be able to be capable of them, although less these days. I also have never asked for a pay rise until recently, when my dean actually said to me in one of the interviews, is there anything else, Helena? And this is my performance review. And I said, no, should there be? And she just laughed and said, I've been doing performance reviews all day with your male colleagues. And
yep.
Actually, your track record is very strong. Every one of them have asked for a pay rise or negotiated something additional.
Yep.
And you never have. And I just sat there and said naively, I thought everybody got the same. To which she just laughed. So even those of ourselves who are in leadership positions still behave in some of those stereotyped ways, and we need to be aware of our own unconscious bias. And I'd be interested to see what Andrew thinks here, because she's in an environment where she's mentored by a range of quite senior women who allow flexibility and expect and encourage. And I'd be interested to see what you think, Andrew, of that sort of opportunity.
When we have that flexibility and I'm mentored, I think it does make a big difference. And I think it actually shows us that we're capable of what we're capable in our career as well. Because even in my PhD, I was actually just focused on my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sort of focused beyond that. But when I had my PhD meetings with my supervisor, she would draw me into not just present, as in the PhD, but what I wanted for the future. And I think that's what good mentoring does, sort of not just focus you in on the future, but where is this actually getting you? That's what good mentoring is to sort of help me, is to shape my career path and understand where I'm going. And so now as I mentor trainees that are coming through, when I see endocrine trainees come through, I will say to them, you know, what are your plans? What are you planning to do after you finish your training? So I think as people sow seeds of mentoring into me, I then do that in turn to other people. And I think it's a good process to invest, I guess, in our future leaders, essentially.
I'm chatting with Helena T, Jackie Boyle, Liz Sexton and Anju Joham about women leaders in medicine. You can find Helena's perspective at mja.com.au. Don't forget you can subscribe to our podcast feed from iTunes or wherever you get your favourite podcasts. And let's get back to our chat. Helena, in your article you mentioned some statistics that are a bit depressing, like in Australia around 30% of deans, chief medical officers or medical college board or committee members are women, while women make up 12.5% of CEOs in large hospitals. We know that we've got gender equity in the medical schools now. That's been that way for a while. Where are we losing them?
We've got more women, in fact, in many of the medical schools and clearly in allied health and nursing. So, in fact, our healthcare professionals are about 75% female, and it's been beautifully described in The Lancet as a leaky pipeline. So the argument was always that, oh, no, we'll... they'll come through. There's more and more coming into the health professions, into medicine, into surgery, and to obstetrics. And as they come through, they'll go into leadership positions. But it hasn't come to pass. So it's been way too slow, and hence the description leaky pipeline. And one of the biggest places it drops off is actually at that, for women who do choose to have a family, and that is the majority of women in healthcare, it drops off. And we know what it does in medicine. It's harder to tell in the other areas of healthcare because the stats aren't as good. But in medicine, women work the same hours as men and tend to have the same positions in their training. But once they hit the average age of about 30 to 32, and we know what happens then, they drop their hours dramatically during that critical career cementing time. And it's not just the maternity leave. And I remember having good discussions, robust discussions with my colleagues at NHMRC about this. You can't just say it's 6 weeks or 6 months or 12 months of mat leave. The reality is I loved having children. I loved being with my children. But just like Andrew has described, you are either guilty when you're a mum because you weren't working, and when you were at work, you were guilty because you weren't being a mum. And it was a catch-22, but I often described it as if you don't have mentoring, you don't have someone to help you structure and coach you through that time, and if your husband or partner is not supportive, it's a bit like putting a sack over your head and a cannonball around your ankles and say, keep on running, because the reality is you just can't do both at the pace you did before. But you don't need much downtime. You know, by the time the kids are in kinder and then school, the hours start to ramp up again. And in fact, women get back to working about the same hours as their male colleagues for the rest of their career. But they just need help and career planning and strategy for that downtime. And that's what doesn't happen, you know, in that sort of career phase. And what happens is what Liz has described, where women actually come to leadership roles perhaps a little bit older, but are still perceived to be early in their career because they've often had to come back in later. And the evidence shows that mentoring really helps women bridge that. They sort of go into head down, backside up, look after children, juggle 20 things, and nobody's necessarily putting their head up and mentoring and strategically getting them through that career stage unless they've really got a good, strong mentor. And I think the other thing to highlight here is that issue about the ethnicity, culturally and linguistically diverse groups, Indigenous groups within women in healthcare are probably more affected. And I don't know, Jackie, whether you want to comment on that?
Well, I'm not sure that we actually have figures, but we know that diversity in leadership across the board in Australia is very low, and that the majority of leaders are of Anglo-Celtic or European background. So, yes, I'm sure that it's an issue. And again, you know, even it's really important to recognise these things specifically and to benchmark them, because otherwise it's very easy for those things to slip under the radar if we focus solely on agenda focus in leadership. There's an example, I think, that really highlights, you know, if you put effort and change the way that you think, sometimes bend the rules a bit and apply a systematic approach, you can affect change. So we have an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Women's Health Committee at the College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And when we started, there was one Aboriginal obstetrician and gynecologist on the committee, and there was an Aboriginal midwife. And now it's comprised of, apart from one non-Aboriginal obstetrician gynecologist, they're all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander obstetricians, gynecologists and trainees. And that's because the college has really made a big effort to support them and mentor them. And instead of having, initially there were, you know, terms of reference around how many people could be on it, but then, you know, you might, as the numbers were growing, you might be leaving one or two of those people out of the committee, which is clearly not a good thing to do. And so they changed it so everyone could be on it, because that's part of that means that you're then supporting and mentoring the next group coming through. So, and it's fantastic. You know, everyone now looks to them for leadership, which, you know, but it's taken time.
Sorry, I was just going to say, maybe that brings us what I think you were going to ask was what we do about it.
Yes, how do we formalise the mentoring progress? How do we make this a standardised way of helping women get through that decade or so where they're trying to do everything?
So I think there is some answers around that. And in the article, we allude to the fact that we need systems and organisational change as well as individual change, because often we've just looked to doing a leadership training program, which really says that it's up to the individual. And there is some value in that, but it needs to be broader than that, as Jackie's just giving you a lovely example. So we now are leading a national initiative with the College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the College of Physicians, who's getting very active in this space, the College of Surgeons, as well as some of the nursing colleges, including leading health services who really want to make this a priority, as well as government.
Yep.
So we've actually got the stakeholders together with leading academics in different fields of clinical medicine, different career stages, with people in business and leadership academia, and with people from different sectors, that, for example, finance industry and others, who can give us some examples of the advances they've made. Recognising health leadership is very different. So leadership in a for-profit sector is about being different, being unique, growing, having a big customer base and making money. Leadership in healthcare, if you're good at it, is actually having no customers because everyone's well, and prevention. It's never about making money. It's not about being standout different, but preferably providing good quality evidence-based care for everyone. And so it's really quite a different model, but there's still more we can learn.
Yeah.
So we have a national initiative now. We've got engagement from all of the groups, and we're addressing those systems, policy, organisation and individual levels with strategies such as, you know, HR and policy change. There's a whole lot of strategies that can change the way an organisation addresses these issues from a cultural perspective, calls out the unconscious bias, addresses those, increases objectivity in employment. Then there's leadership and development programs and mentoring programs for men and women. Most of our leaders are still male, so they need to know how to do this as well, and they often want to know. So there's a whole range of strategies. And the really exciting thing about this, I think, Kate, is that it's evidence-based, but it takes the whole process through, and it will involve a digital platform where basically all the partners and organisations will enter information on the evidence-based agreed strategies they want to put in place. They'll then get a benchmark report to tell them how they're going compared to others, and then they'll get facilitated improvement on how to change and improve wherever they are on the journey. And then the following year, they'll get the same process. So it's ongoing measurable change, because if we don't measure it and we don't take an evidence-based approach, everyone's duplicating ad hoc and they're just not really moving forward.
Right. So where is this strategy in terms of pragmatic implementation? Where is it at?
Some of it's reasonably well developed, like the leadership development program, but the stakeholder engagement, so getting all the groups together. But what we're now doing is we're just going in for an NHMRC partnership grant. so that we can get matched funding with all of those organisations who've all put cash and in kind on the table. That will allow us to continue to do the work we need to do. Some of the work involving the digital platform is underway in terms of measurement. Quite a bit of the formative engagement work and mapping of existing activity is underway. So lots of pockets of activity, but the NHMRC grant will really just bring all of that together so that we can make it that systems approach.
Liz, how do you think that's going to change things on the coalface?
I'm hoping it will make a difference, and I think it's really important, and Helena highlighted this, that men are involved in leadership training as well.
Yep.
What I see in surgery is most, if not all, the men in leadership, certainly where I work, have not done any leadership training at all. And when you're someone who's actually invested a lot of time into leadership development but also to deliver leadership training, and it's very evident that they don't actually understand some of the key points of leadership, so they tend to pick like for like. So we have this continual, if you like, sort of train of picking people who are like the people who are already in positions,
yes,
rather than people who have different ideas. And there was one of the meetings I was at with the College of Surgeons that came up about leadership training, and in the room it was supposed to be all the surgical directors and people in leadership. And there was a question, you know, who thinks leadership training is worthwhile? All the women put their hand up and virtually only two men put their hand up. And it was very enlightening to see that the difference in attitude between what it means to be a leader, and that leadership skills are something that you need to work on the same as your surgery. You have to invest time in it, you have to develop it, and you have to practice the craft. It doesn't just happen because you're given a title.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting, Liz, because that's the assumption that many of our colleagues have, that they know how to lead, and that they do lead because of the qualification, whereas we find with most of the women that they may want to lead but assume they don't necessarily have quite all the skills that they need. So the other thing just on that, though, is that we now know that there's not a single leadership program in healthcare that's interprofessional or that supports medical professionals at all. So not just women or men, but any of them that's actually been formally evaluated and published.
Wow.
There's only a few in nursing, and they weren't actually primarily around leadership. So one of the problems is many of these, because they have the word leadership in them, are $3,000 to $5,000 for 2 days. And there are lots of great leaders talking at you rather than true reflective coaching as well as role models in an evidence-based approach to leadership development. And we argue in the article, we need to move away from this corporate style of leadership training at high cost, which is unjustified, to make it something that is accessible, multifaceted, has some online components, some face-to-face, some brief for early career, and then some perhaps more extensive offerings that could fit either a module in an MBA or be a standalone, without that dollar value that basically makes it prohibitive for the many numbers of women and men we need to put through this sort of program in medicine.
Is there a role for the medical schools in this?
Yeah, look, interestingly, the thing about leadership development is you need some raw life experience. I mean, we'll wait and see what the others think, but it's usually something you do as you mature. And I think being aware of what Liz said really articulately, that you're not a leader because you've got a medical degree. And, you know, although once you're on the ward, you have to lead a team and you do get thrown in off the deep end, there can't be an assumption that you have the skills. If you don't develop them, you don't have self-awareness and self-management, and you can't hone them through your career.
Mm.
So I think there is an awareness issue in medical school, but I don't think it's the place that we would do most of our leadership development.
Right.
But I'd be interested to see what the others would reflect on that.
What do you think, Anju?
I think I actually teach some third-year medical students, and I think that most of them would not be probably ready or want to do leadership training.
Mm-hmm.
I think you couldn't apply that globally across them, because some of them potentially through various life experiences, or perhaps if they're postgrad students, or perhaps a particularly mature undergraduate student, might be ready. But I think generally I think a bit of life experience and a bit of work experience gives them some sort of foundation to sort of hang the leadership training onto, which I think is important. Otherwise, I don't think they're really ready for the leadership training, in my opinion.
Jackie, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I disagree, actually.
Okay.
Yay.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the medical college is, it may not be the right place to do it. I'm not sure about that. But I have worked with some amazing young medical students who are already leaders. A lot of them who do a lot of volunteer work outside medicine, who are very involved in, for example, the rural and Indigenous health networks, the global health networks, some of them who've set up not-for-profits. I think there's certainly amazing potential that can be fostered with medical students. You know, maybe not all of them are interested, but I certainly think there are some people who may not necessarily be trying to be leaders, but they actually are.
But maybe that's a salient point, that there are people at different career stages, right from early through to, in fact, older career. And we know that, you know, that, as I said, women often get to those more senior positions later because of that hiatus in their career.
Yes.
So it might be that there's different touch points, different delivery methods, and that's what this project will determine, how women and men, what their needs are, what their focus is. But I must say this national project is primarily focused on advancing women in leadership,
mm-hmm.
acknowledging there's points that we need leadership across the board.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a broader thing. We do need to train our male leaders how to mentor and facilitate women. But I just make one extra point. And recently, all of us have been challenged by whether we should be doing some of this training as only women or as both, you know, all genders together.
Yep.
And interestingly, there's some recent evidence that's come out of Harvard Business School that, much like school, women actually do better in these sorts of programs and network more extensively, learn and participate more when it's women only. Men actually do better when it's both. So it's a bit like the co-ed school and the single-sex school.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting. So we do actually still, most of our programs for leadership are primarily for women, but we have programs to facilitate, support and assist male leaders around promoting this. But it's a lot of the work we do is for groups of women, and it's good to see the evidence supports that.
I would just like to highlight that it's not just about improving, you know, leadership and life for women or for people from diverse backgrounds. The evidence is that in, you know, businesses and in healthcare, that if you have more diversity in leadership, that's better for the organisations as well. So I think that's a really important point as well that we all need to be aware of.
To get better outcomes.
I would agree exactly with that comment, that it's about being able to see things from a different point of view, because that reflects society. And I remember listening to Aisha Buttrose at a conference once, and this was, a beautiful description of it. Someone wanted to come in and they wanted to put some sanitary products into Clio magazine. Basically came in and put this pad on the table. And they just sat there and looked at it, and he's like, "We just want to put it, you know, in the magazine." And the women there turned around and sort of said, "Well, that's not how you do it. You have to do this, you have to do that. It needs to be sterile." And the guy hadn't even thought about it. But between them, they came up with, you know, this really, really clever idea of putting little things in the magazine that was ended up being a great sales marketing exploit. And it's just having that different point of view. If Aisha hadn't have been the editor of the magazine or involved in that, that may not have happened, and it would have been a flop. So by having those different perspectives, it really allows for the best outcomes to come to fruition.
And I think one of the value of the leadership courses is that I never aspired to leadership because I don't think I really understood what leadership was, because
yes.
I always saw that as someone who's up there in a big leadership position. But I've now come to understand that being in a leadership position enables you to influence, and it's just being in a position to influence. And that is something I do want to do. I do want to improve healthcare. I do want to improve the health outcomes for my patients. And I think, especially in the hospital setting or in the research setting, that is what pretty much everyone would aspire to as well. So when I talk to other people and I talk to them about the leadership courses, when I put it that way, they say, "Oh, actually, I do want to do that. And most people don't realise that they're actually already in some way, actually already in a leadership position. So I think it actually opens people's eyes to what leadership is actually about, and then that actually changes their perspective.
I think what you just said, Andrew, is absolutely spot on, and it's really important to understand that leadership is actually not about the position. It's about the impact and the influence that you can create regardless of your position. When people start thinking about that and understand what their purpose is, then that's when you see leadership coming to the fore, and I do believe that's something that women can excel at.
Excellent. In fact, Hillary Clinton and Julia Gillard emphasised that a great deal.
Yeah.
I said women tend to think leadership is working very hard, putting their, you know, their head down, the backside up, because they don't want to command, control, power type of model. And it's not just women. I have to say it's a younger generation of men as well.
Mm.
In fact, many people who don't like the traditionally masculine, not necessarily male, but masculine traditional styles of authoritative leadership think they can't or won't lead because they don't want to function like that. But actually, just as Anya beautifully articulated, it's really about, do you want to have influence and impact? Because that is actually what power and leadership is.
Mm.
And I remember that was a critical turning point in my career when my the MBA program facilitator said exactly that. And I went, oh, actually, I do want to have that influence. I do want to lead. And Liz is absolutely spot on. In fact, my current role, I work across organisations with 85,000 employees, and 5 of them work for me in that role. But I influence across all of them,
yeah.
And I influence across the states and nationally, and it's all about that influence piece. So that's a really good place to finish, perhaps, Kate.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for coming together at this hour on a Friday, folks. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.